Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with Sharon Matola, founder and director of the Belize Zoo, in the first of a two-part interview. Today we'll talk about the founding of the zoo and everyday life there. We'll also focus on her work with harpy eagles, jaguars, and jaguar rehabilitation. In 1983, she started the Belize Zoo to provide a home for a collection of 20 wild animals, including a jaguar, two macaws, a 10-foot boa constrictor, and 17 others that were used in a documentary film she'd worked on about tropical forests. The problem was that once you domesticate wild animals, they can't care for themselves in the wild. Today, the Belize Zoo and Tropical Education Center has grown to about 170 animals, including jaguars, tapirs, harpy eagles, and macaws. No animal in this zoo was ever taken from the wild. Rather, they were either injured and brought in for healing and rehabilitation, people's pets that were donated to the zoo, animals born at the zoo, or animals sent to the zoo from another zoological facility. The main purpose of this zoo is to educate Belizeans about their natural resources. Not only does the zoo contain only Belizean animals, but it also has many educational programs for adults and school children alike. In addition, Sharon has written several books featuring zoo animals, including a series about Hoodwink the Owl for school children, one about Junior Buddy, one of the zoo's most famous jaguars, and another about Tombo the Tapir that's still in the works. One of the things Sharon is best known for is her work rescuing and rehabilitating rare creatures. She is often referred to as either the Dr. Doolittle of Belize or else the Jane Goodall of jaguars. In part, that's because of the rehabilitation program she's established for problem jaguars. Through this program, Sharon Matola trains jaguars who have killed livestock or otherwise become a problem so that they'll be less aggressive. When we spoke recently, I asked Sharon how she came to start Belize's first and only zoo.
It wasn't with much planning or thought. I was working as a filming assistant for a wildlife documentary filmmaker and managing his animals. We had about 20, and that was back in 1982. What happened was the film that he was contracted to complete was finished, and so that was a three-month job, and he was sent to Borneo, and there was no funding to maintain the animal collection. So basically, it was, okay, get rid of the animals. And that was from the parent film company. There isn't a lot of funds available anyway for documentary films, and to feed animals that weren't serving any filming purpose was not in a company's agenda. So I was given that task, get rid of the animals. Well, he went off to Borneo to complete another film, and I said, well, I can't get rid of these animals. What can you do? Once an animal is imprinted and tamed, you can't put them back into the wild. Maybe you could find people who would take them in as pets. Well, you don't want to do that. But they were just my friends, basically. Back in 1982, Belize was a real frontier. And when you manage animals, you become close to them. So I said, you know, Belize doesn't have a zoo. I think I'll start a zoo, and that's how it started. Basically, that's how it started. That's not why it developed, but that's how it started.
And what was the film? Can people still see that film and see some of these founding members of the first zoo?
Yeah, I believe, in fact, it is periodically shown on television, and it's called Solda Verde, which means green forest, and it's a beautiful film. But it also led me, initially I thought I was doing a great service to conservation, which I always wanted to. I wanted to work in nature conservation. So here I am fulfilling that dream by working in documentary film. And the film was beautiful and would show people the beauty of the rainforest. Therefore, we should keep it done. However, when I started the zoo, and this was before, you've never been to Belize or have you been to Belize?
I have not been to Belize.
Okay, this was before the Western Highway was completely paved, so to get out to this little roadside attraction was a major deal. And what surprised me when I started the zoo was because it was just word of mouth. I mean, I rode my bicycle up to the bar 3 miles away, which was called JB's, and I said, "Hey, JB, if anybody's bored, send them down to Richard's place and tell them it's a zoo now." And that's how it started. But what surprised me was the word of mouth component and the amount of lesions that were dropping in. And when I say amount, maybe 5 a week. Okay. I just was surprised. And that started to increase. And I just still didn't understand why people were putting forward that effort to stare at these animals. And I mean, chicken wire came to me. It never occurred to me what was going on. I mean, why don't they turn on their TVs and watch the film we make, you know? Me in my cloud of unawareness. And then one day, this was after I was, you know, a few months of the zoo being there, and I was doing this all by myself. It was a lot of work. I was dedicated and committed to seeing that, you know, this place would be taken care of on this limited level that I could strive to attain, you know, some type of continuity for the animals. And anyway, I enjoyed the local folks dropping in now and again, and this really, really old man stopped in at the very end of the day one day. And I thought, oh, I'm so tired. And I never let people wander around in there. It was too dangerous. I mean, literally, doors, if you leaned against them, would fall apart with termites. And that happened once with a jaguar. So it wasn't exactly a visitor-safe zoo. Everybody had to be escorted. Well, here comes this ancient man. And, Miss, oh God, I'm tired. And so I go, Emily, how can you turn down an ancient old man who you know took the bus and walked down this, you know, a quarter of a mile of a dusty road to come to this ramshackle roadside attraction? So, sure, I can do that. And we started walking around. And the old fellow had one fable after the next about the animals of Belize. Oh, the anteater. Oh, very dangerous animal. It's going to take your dog, force its tongue up your dog's nose, and suck out its brains. Oh, whoa, really? And how the curassow, which is a forest bird, that's another dangerous animal for your dog. They eat that, they're going to be poisoned and die. And I just remember going back into the house and getting a piece of paper and pen to write his notions down. It was so extraordinary to me. When we came to the jaguars, we had a pair of jaguars, and they were rolling around in the late afternoon sun. It was so beautiful, and they were just playing. And I didn't say anything. He didn't say anything. We just watched them. And then he broke down and cried. And I thought, I stupidly thought it was another dog story. You know, a jaguar ate his dog, or, you know, it's a dangerous animal. But it wasn't that. He looked me in the eye, and he said, "I'm really sorry, miss. I've lived in Belize my whole life, and this is the first time I've seen the animals of my country." And life changed. My life changed right there. It was as if I had a lightning bolt of awareness strike me. And I thought, wow, how in the world can we expect people in developing countries to respect their natural resources when they have no idea what these resources are? And that's what drove me into a really hard commitment to see that I could turn that little backyard zoo into the most dynamic wildlife education center that country would ever see. And that's what happened. And that's how it really started. And that's what kept me there.
And now it's not only one of the biggest tourist attractions in the country, but it's also a huge educational center. Is that right?
Our priority is education. I love it that tourists come here. Obviously, tourists come here because they do have an interest in conservation and wildlife, and that's very pleasing to know. Our real focus is getting the kids here, getting communities here, getting people to fall in love with their own animals so they want them here forever, and that is really what's the driving force behind the Belize Zoo.
So tell me about some of the residents. Can you take me on a little tour of the zoo?
Sure. That's easy. Our residents are very special. each animal is special. And I think what's amazing to me is that they've all been, you know, they all have a strange history. These are animals that were kept as pets and mistreated, or rehab animals, or brought to us nearly dead. And, you know, we bring them back to life and then give them TLC to the max and work with them every day so that when our school kids come, they don't run away from the kids. We have this one tapir who was being kept illegally as a pet, who we raised. And when he came here, he was really in bad shape. He was a baby. Well, we hand-raised him. His name is Indy, and he still likes to have his baba. Well, what a treat. You know, you have a six-year-old little girl, little boy, take this huge cow bottle and feed it to a tapir, and they're thrilled, and there's a connection, and the look in the eyes of the child is an unforgettable event for me. I mean, they sparkle. And so we keep him bottle fed. He loves it. They love it. And he's got a charming little personality. Comes over. They look like they could, you know, they look strange. I don't know if you have seen tapirs, but they're related. They're ancient. They're related to the rhino. They are very unusual looking animals with unpredictable personalities, but because we work with our tapirs, they just come trundling over to meet their guests, and that's always a hit. And
tapirs in the wild are very difficult to see. I know I've tried to see tapirs in various places, Costa Rica and elsewhere, but have yet to see one in the wild.
I used to see them every day when I worked on my Scarlet McCall study up where they put in Chile OGM. So I could have taken you to see a tapir easily. However, that can't happen anymore. Anyway, the other animals that are special, I have to talk about the harpy eagles. The harpy eagle, considered to be pretty much extinct in Central America, and we worked in a collaborative program with the Peregrine Fund, which, of course, you're probably aware of. They're active in the United States. These eagles were captive bred in Panama and then trained to be independent hunters and brought to Belize as a restoration project to put them back in forests where they once lived but don't live anymore. So to date, we've successfully released 15 eagles. We know 12 have survived. Two did not make it in the forest. The first was a captive bred male named Panama, who, when he did hatch, his left eye was damaged, so he was given to us as an education bird. Now, I was told, because I did raise the boy, you can only hand feed him for 2 years, and then that's it. He's going to be very aggressive, and you can't trust him. I said, oh, okay, thank you for the advice. So, of course, he's going to be 9 in November, and it's his 9th birthday party with tons of kids singing his birthday song, and he's still hand-fed. He still lets me kiss his little talons. He still lets me get an inch and a half away from him, and he lets me take people in to enjoy him. So he is a star. Has he turned this country? First of all, when the program started, nobody knew what a harpy eagle was. Nobody understood they're residents of Belize, or used to be, and now the country is enamored with them.
Can you describe the harpy eagle?
I would love to describe Panama. Well, first of all, you have to realize how large they are. They're one of the four largest eagles in the world. And with a wingspan of 6 feet, the females are larger than the males. I have a female as well. He's a white and gray bird with beautiful kind of banded trouser legs, a gorgeous round face, a great crest that goes up when he's alert, and big dark eyes to die for. And the sad thing about him, and all harpy eagles, because when the program was in full flight, I was going out in the field with the biologists who were tracking them, and they're such gentle-spirited birds. Yeah, they're top predators. They're not gentle-spirited if you're an iguana or a tinkajou or some prey item, but they are so curious, and it would not harm a person. Panama, he looks like he could take your head off. And when I take people in there, I say, look, just remember this. He looks ferocious. but he's Tweety Bird in that big body. He's a Tweety Bird. And he just puts those wings out, and he just starts looking at you, and I can see the fear in people, and I say, don't be afraid, he's okay. And then he calms down, and you can hand feed him, and he's a happy guy. He loves the attention. In fact, I have to say that if it weren't for Panama, there would not be a stamp issue now in Belize with the Harpy Eagle as a 50-cent stamp, which I am thrilled over. He has put the Harpy Eagle in a place in Belize, which is a beloved place, and I just, it's just so satisfying knowing that.
So each of these animals almost acts as an ambassador for their species.
Absolutely. That is the top word that can be used to describe them. Yeah, they are.
And you also mentioned anteaters. Do you have anteater ambassadors?
We have had anteaters. We don't have anteaters at this time. Our animals are dependent on government confiscating animals, except illegally, or people giving them to us because they tire of them to pets. So we don't have an anteater right now, but we have had in the past. And yeah, they are definitely our ambassadors. See, we thread a theme through the whole zoo that you like the anteater. The anteater needs forest to survive. Don't you love the harpy eagle? Without good, healthy forest, the harpy eagle cannot survive. Aren't the jaguars beautiful? Unless we keep that corridor healthy and vibrant, the jaguar won't be here. So it's a reoccurring theme. It's the animal characters that step in and out on the stage. But the theme remains the same. Keep the forest, you keep the animals.
And then some of your most famous ambassadors have been jaguars. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a very special animal for me. And I've had personal experiences with them, and I've seen what animals can do to really form a solid bond between people, and it's the jaguar. I mean, they're stunning to look at, and when you see one up close, which that's what our jaguars have, which is a quality that everyone appreciates. You can get inches away from them. Junior Buddy, he's our famous boy. He has a book coming out about him, two books.
The book is called The Story of Junior Buddy, Our Belizean Treasure, and it's coming out in October 2010. Is that right?
Well, no. Actually, it is coming out in October, but that's my book that I wrote. And the other book is the Scholastic book, which is geared at five-year-olds, and that's more of a kid's book about a little baby jaguar who, ended up in a situation that has pleased him and made people lucky to see him, that kind of happy story. They're both similar, but ours, of course, is far more involved. But Junior, his story, he would have died. He wouldn't have ever even been born if it hadn't been for the problem rehab program problem jaguar rehabilitation program that was started in 2003.
So tell me why are jaguars a problem? Tell me, why you needed that type of program.
I know. Why would such a beautiful animal become a problem? Well, there's a situation where their habitat has been decreased and their prey base also has been decreased because people like to hunt and eat the same animals that jaguars need to hunt and eat, like peccaries and deer and pacas and armadillos. So these animals form the basic prey base for a jaguar. Now, reduce the prey base and reduce the habitat and then throw in a cattle farm. If you were a hungry jaguar, what would you think? Wow, look at that. Look at that cow. This is jaguar heaven. So you take a cow. And the only thing the jaguar doesn't understand is that there's a cattle farmer who's not really pleased about that. And what happens is the jaguar returns again and again. in many times, it's been shown that if it's a female with cubs, she teaches her cubs that trick. This is easy prey. And what happened was government didn't know what to do. The cats were being shot. They're being poisoned. It was called a problem cat, and it was okay to shoot them. I found out about it and thought that it was not a good direction to go and figured, wait a second, I also have zoo connections. I know that there is a great need for new genetic material in the captive population in the state, so hey, why not capture these animals? I'll put them through a behavioral modification program called Jaguar Rehab, make them friendly cats, and we'll use them as important genetic input, which is badly needed. That's how it started. I received full support for the government because they gave them an option more positive than what was going on. U.S. Fish and Wildlife liked it. Everybody was on board. The zoos loved it. They needed fresh genetics in their jaguar population, so off we go. And that's how it started. Now, how it evolved was that, okay, two cats were sent to zoos in the state. They are living splendid lives. In fact, the one in Milwaukee has become a megastar up there, turning a lot of people on to what's going on down here with jaguar conservation.
So that's in Milwaukee, that's one of the ones that had been gone through your rehab program?
Yeah, that's Pat the Cat. He was a cattle filler. And anyway, in November, 3 Novembers ago now, we received a very young female who was extremely ill, really ill. The vet didn't understand why she was still alive. The white blood count was huge. And red blood count was nothing. Nobody could understand, why is she even alive? So we worked really hard to save her life. She was a sheep killer. She came from a little town named Springfield, a Mennonite community, who were kind enough not to kill her and call us instead. And we didn't know she was pregnant when she got here. So lo and behold, 3 months after Springfield arrived, and we recuperated her health to a wonderful level. She's now, she came through her bad time. And, I mean, you wouldn't believe it. She had over 50 big maggots in her, and oh, she's a mess. And then she gave birth to this cub. Shocked everybody. No one knew she was pregnant. And here's this little baby, and I thought, oh, amazing. So the one thing about cats in captivity, sometimes they'll reject their young. Well, we saw no rejection in the first 2 days, and everybody's really glad, holding their breath. Oh, this is great. This is wonderful. This is going to be a great little family, addition to the Belize Zoo. But to our dismay, on the third day, in February, in the cold dampness of that little den, he was lying in a corner, crying for his mom, and she could not care less. She was as far away as she could be, licking her paws and acting like there was no little baby jaguar there. So we hand-raised him from that point. And the story from there is when he was very, very young, probably, I would say, less than a month, I started a behavior program with him because, number one, you can't put them in the wild. It's very difficult to even introduce them to the cats in the zoo because they are hand-raised. It's another animal into another cat's territory. But I thought, what if we work with him every day and really make him a fun-loving jaguar and turn him into a sterling, shining ambassador for his species. So every morning I would trudge over, pick him up in my arms, carry him out to a larger exhibit in the back in rehab, and we would play. And he would roll over, which evolved into his somersaults. I'd put him in the pond and try to teach him to lake water and swim. And he was, and just to kind of follow me around, climb up on logs, just to do all the things that you want him to do, but have fun doing it. And that went on for a long time. And then it changed into a more, I would say, structured behavior program where he took what he learned as a cub and for positive reward, just does it on command. And he's really smart. Jaguars are so smart.
Really?
And they have the largest brain per body weight of any of the four cats. They are tremendously intelligent. So he has had no problem in learning. What is pleasing to me is that he enjoys it. Like, that cat is absolutely in heaven doing his junior buddy routine.
And what is his junior buddy routine?
Well, there's two junior buddy routines. First of all, he counts. He comes up to the fence with visitors. This is the junior buddy routine that everyone sees. And you say, okay, junior buddy, I told them you're a smart guy because jaguars are the smartest of all the big cats. Now you show them you can count. You're 3 years old. Now, the thing is, the repetitive trial is what breaks in the animal. So he knows the voice. He knows the command. So he knows he has to climb up way high on his log 3 times. And then I ask the people, or the keepers ask the people, okay, when he gets to the top, you have to clap for him. And he loves the applause. So he gets to the top, and everybody claps, and then he listens for it. I said, Junior Buddy, you are 3. That's only 1. What do you have to do? So up he goes again. So he does it 3 times, and then he comes over and gets his little treat. And everybody's happy, and he's happy. And then that's the one everybody sees. But we have Jaguar Encounter, where he's locked away, and then I take people into a cage, much like a shark cage, I guess. And then he comes out and comes over, and you give people the briefing on don't put your fingers in his mouth. That's the only rule. But he loves to be pet, and he comes over, and you can pet his fur and scratch him behind the ear, and he's just loving it. And then he does somersaults on command. And nothing is more amazing than seeing a jaguar do a somersault. And so he does his somersault, and then his next trip is a alley-up, and say, okay, Junior, alley-up. And this really is a mind-blower. If you can imagine, you're on the other side of a jaguar. In other words, he's walking around, or he's standing right on top of the cage, and you're looking up at this elegant white and black belly, and you just think, oh, is there anything more beautiful? And I'm so close to it. And you can touch his paws. You can feel the pads. And then, you know, for the education part of it, we explained that they scent mark through their paws and, you know, look at their claws, they're retractable. Look at this animal. Then there's another bonus, which I found out later on as we developed this training. The boy is in love with bald-headed men. In love.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know,
how does he express that love?
Well, as soon as there's a baldy in there, or you know how some of these guys have their hair skin-headed?
Right.
You know? Yeah. Well, he loves them, too. And the interesting thing to me is that, how does he express it? I said, okay, now trust me on this. It's not going to hurt, and he's not going to hurt you, but put your head right next to that cage. And so, and I said, look, please, just do it. And then I say, okay, Junior, there's your head, and he comes walking over, and he starts kissing the head.
Really?
With such relish. Now, the interesting thing to me is that some heads, you can't pull him, you can't get the boy's attention away from. I mean, he'll lie down, and he'll give it, and close his eyes, and just lick, lick, kiss, kiss, lick, lick. Some heads do that to him. Other heads, it's a quick swipe, and that's it. And I'm thinking, you know, there must be something we really do give off on a very individual level. Because I'll say, because obviously it's not the shampoo. These are bald-headed men.
So I wonder what it is.
I don't know, but is it the same thing that has caused me to get over 14 maggots in my head at a time? Why my head and not my leg? Why my head and not my butt? There's something that comes out of our heads, I think, that we don't smell, but other organisms do. I don't know. Look, I can't unexperience the experience. But I'm telling you, the cat goes nuts over certain heads. And I think it's really interesting. And then people, can you imagine what it must be like to be able to sit there over dinner and say, I got kissed by a jaguar. And now you have to realize that while you're in the cage, that you're getting a lot of jaguar ecology lessons from whoever's in there. How rare they are, that you're in the middle of the jaguar corridor, that they're top predators, that, you know, they're exquisite, they've been around for so long. We have to really work hard to conserve what we have. And so the lessons are reinforced while you're in there. And my idea is that when you walk out of there, and people say it's a life-changing experience, I've heard that more than once, you walk out of there with not a different perception of a jaguar, but an unmatched understanding and perception of an animal that is so magnificent and so loyal in its own sense that to lose it would be losing too much, too much.
And what first got you interested in jaguars? Was that one of your original 20 residents?
It was one of my original 20 residents, but I can't, I was a lion tamer at one point in my life, and so I've worked with cats before, and I've always found the positive reward part of animal training to be very interesting, in that you can transfer that strategy to other species, not just felines, but birds and crocodiles, all sorts of animals, dogs, everybody knows that. But it's interesting to see it happen on a wild animal level. Mind you, there's still wild animals, but there isn't any animal that does not respond to positive reinforcement. So what got me interested in the jaguar was that I worked closely with tigers and lions for a year. And I don't agree with that type of work, but what compelled me to do it was the fact that it was animal behavior work, and I wanted to get a little my feet wet on that level.
And has that made a difference in your jaguar rehab, your work as a lion tamer?
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. Oh yeah, definitely. It's because there are certain similarities between all cats that I picked up on early on. But the big thing is that they are the boss, and you need to understand that working within that mindset is vital to getting their respect and getting them to accept positive reward. Because I have to say, there are certain people that none of the jaguars would take food from here. And that's only because, not because they've been mistreated, but because the one guy in particular who's a stellar zoo employee, he works closely with our vets. And he is associated with pain and medication and all of that. I am never around on any vet procedures. I appear after the animal is, you know, finished with, clasping my hand to my heart and saying, oh, my poor darling, what happened? Tell me. Here's your little chicken treat. So I'm always the hero. But in other words, I don't care how hungry the animal is. If there's not a positive association on that emotional and mental level, they're not going to eat. And they will be stubborn, and they will not eat, and they will not respond, and they will not portray any type of positive behavior that you're looking for in order to have that somatic animal bond that you really want to formulate so that people see how special the animal is, not how frightened it is. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now, he's not the first, Junior Buddy's not the first jaguar you've been close to, or is he?
Oh, no. I had a jaguar that used to come into my office in a cage and spend some time there. And then there was Wild Boy, my first rehab prospect who was the big gamble. And that's an interesting story because he was mistreated when he was trapped, and government had obliged my request to begin this program. So they took him from his cattle-killing territory from where he was being kept captive down south and brought him to the zoo. And he was a maniac, hence the name Wild Boy. He was put in his management cage. Every time myself or anybody walked near, he would rush the cage. And you'd think, stop doing that. I mean, his whole face was bloody. His nose was always bleeding because he just didn't care. He wanted out. And I thought, you know what, maybe I've made a mistake here. Maybe I've really thought about a program that just isn't going to work. And then I said, you know what, I'm not giving up on Wild Boy. So every day I would go there, and the way the management cages are, you can separate them. You can put a fence across the inside management cage. So I would sit in one side, and he would sit in the other. I would always have a plate of chicken, and I would just sit there, and I'd talk to him. I'd do my work there, and I really liked it. Don't bother Sharon, she's with Wild Boy. but would he eat? Would he eat? This went on for nearly a week. And he had to be hungry. I did an experiment. I said, okay, buddy, you're not going to eat. I'm not going to eat. And I would only allow myself coffee. I had to have coffee, for God's sake. He can't got his water, I'll have my coffee. But I tell you, by the end of the day, if somebody would have thrown me a crust of white bread, I would have been grateful. It's hard to sit there and not eat. And he was doing it for more than 3 days. Now we're on day four. Now it's day five. And I'm thinking, how can these animals do this? Now, here's what happened. There comes a car. Now, this is an amazing story. I'm walking up to his cage again, up to the management cage, and here comes a forest department vehicle with the forest officers getting out to check on the program, and I thought, ugh. So I said, they came over, and there's Wild Boy, you know, looking like Wild Boy, like he's going to attack the wall again. How's it going? I said, you know, it's really going well. This cat is really responding. It's amazing. I said, but let me tell you something. You're here. You're strangers. He sees the uniform. Don't be surprised if he does something aggressive, like leaps towards the fence or I can guarantee you, he won't eat in front of you. So nobody says anything. And I said, well, I'll give it a try. And can you believe this? So I walk up to the outside of the management cage. I'll never forget this as long as I live. I said, okay, Wild Boy, here's your chicken. Wild Boy came over and ate it out of my hand like a gentle kitten.
Really?
I almost dropped over. It's as if he knew that he could trust me, that something was going on, and he was damn hungry on top of it. But at that point in time, he ate, and he ate the entire plate of food. And I just turned to the forest officials, and I said, see? Isn't it great? It's working. And from that point on, well, Wild Boy and I were just best of buds. It was a very flabbergasting moment, and, you know, I thought one of the more amazing things was I held my composure. I couldn't believe it.
And did you act like it was always the case?
Yep. I said, I can't believe it. I guess he's not threatened by you at all. And they went away happy that the program was working, you know, that they didn't have to worry that they had put a stamp of approval on something that, you know, was a bit out of line. So it was a good day.
I wanted to talk more about what actually goes into jaguar rehabilitation. You know, what is the process? How did you start when you got Wild Boy?
Well, I'll use Wild Boy as an example because he was the first, and that probably is the best example to use because it was all experimental. Now I pretty much know how to approach them and what their reaction is going to be. But with Wild Boy, I didn't because he was the first one. And I, dealt with animals for so long, I just understood that I would have to be on his schedule, and it was his agenda, and no matter what I wanted to do, it was wildly in control. But I'm a very big believer of reinforcement. So what it took was my spending, really, Laurel, the most important thing was the amount of time one spends with them. And I see that repeatedly in every animal that comes in. If you spend time with them, they change depending on their former situation, but they really do have a fairly rapid turnover in behavior if you spend time with them and it's positive time. So that's what I concentrated on with Wild Boy. And I don't know if you remember, but I said the way the rehab is set up, they're in management pens, which can be divided into two. So I'm on one side, and it's on the other with a, you know, a gate in front of it. And he just becomes accustomed to my presence there. Then I do bring the guitar in, talk to him. I have food. I always use the guitar for every cat.
The cats like music.
Oh, they love it. And Wild Boy especially liked it. He, after he was used to my going back there with the guitar, he would actually, I mean, if you can believe it, move his bum back and forth. He would sit down and I would play a song and he would move his bum back and forth. And I said, Wild Boy, if you can learn to do that on command, we're going on Dave Letterman. Come on. But he just, they all enjoy guitar, all of them.
Are there any particular songs that they prefer or types of music?
Well, they have their own songs. They have their names in their songs, and it's just simple little tunes. And so, yeah, I would say that the song is something, it becomes something that they know is coming. They know it's coming, and after the song, they get a treat. So that's how the song thing works. And now and again, I go back into rehab, and I just take my guitar and sit and play, and they all like it. They all roll over. They like the sound of the guitar, and they just seem calm. It works as a calming, soothing remedy more than anything else. And so I do that in the very beginning. And every day, every day, every day, no matter what my schedule is, I can put aside a couple of hours a day, even if it means arriving to the zoo at a, you know, an earlier hour than I usually do. It's still possible. You never erase the consecutive day aspect of it. It's just something that becomes very routine.
What happens after sort of they get used to you and calming? Then do you start with any hands-on work or?
Well, after they are calmed down and they're used to eating, they have to eat from my hand. When that happens, then they learn tricks, and that's when the fun really begins, because it's fun to teach them and they understand good boy or good girl, and they understand when they've done the trick because they get a piece of meat, so they do the trick again, and it's just fun. So that's the next step, and those tricks are learned in the management area.
What kind of tricks are they?
Well, there's a high five. So when I say high five, their paw goes up. When I say roll, then they roll over and do a little somersault. And you have to keep in mind that, you know, putting their paw up is a natural behavior. They're curious cats, and they will paw at things, especially logs. And they all love to roll over. They all love to roll. I mean, when I play the guitar, they roll on their backs. Junior Buddy rolled on his back as a little cub, and so he learned quite quickly that a roll was a fun thing to do, and he got positively reinforced from the time he was a little fellow, and that's why he's so eager to do it now. But they all do it. There's one rehab cat that comes out on zoo grounds when he's called, and he's an education rehab cat. So if, say, for instance, if you were visiting, you would be able to climb up and be face-to-face with this jaguar, and you would actually make him roll, and you would give him a high five. He's a huge hit, especially with kids. And then I get to explain, or my keepers will explain the program and what behavior modification is. And he teaches people how smart jaguars are. You can get so close to them, look them in the eye, and appreciate that police still has them here. So he has a very valuable role. He absolutely astounds people. He's an amazing cat. So that, his name is Fieldmaster. He was an incorrigible dog killer.
Really?
Yeah.
And now he's one of the stars.
Now he's the prima donna. He loves coming out. He
he comes out and he's learned that if he stalks before he comes out, everybody gasps, and then he appears, and then he starts rolling, and he's an intense guy. He's one of the cats that has these huge golden eyes that just, they grab you and they just stare at you.
How did he come to your zoo? Yeah, how did he come
was,
to your...
He was one of the cats that someone, rather than shooting him, knew the zoo had a program, and they called Forest Department, and we went and trapped him. He was very easy to trap. These problem cats become bold because they'll get their prey, and they won't be bothered, and they just keep returning for prey. That's how they get caught. And he was coming right up, just staying under the people's house and just nicking off their dogs. So something had to be done. He was trapped and brought to the zoo and went through rehab.
And how long does a rehab program generally take?
Okay, that's a good question. It's considered to be the successful element is when they're let out of management into their big run. And in other words, it's almost exhibit size, so they can climb trees. A couple of them have ponds and act like wild jaguars if they wish. And so that's the big step. And in order to do that, I mean, mind you, the enclosures are chain link. So you want to really make sure that they're happy and content, because a jaguar can definitely tear through chain link if they want. So that's the determining factor. Is this cat ready to be let out and trusted? They're not captive bred. They haven't spent a life in any captive situation other than this behavior modification program. So it's pretty much my call. And by the time they are let out, and I would say the time between when they arrive to the time they're let out is about 3 months.
Now, they cannot go back into the wild.
I wish they could, but no, they can't. Interestingly, all the cats go through thorough medical exams, and there is always something wrong with them. Missing claws, missing teeth, all of them. I mean, every cat examined has had shotgun pellets in them. So they've been shot. And this has all contributed to their not being able to effectively hunt in the wild. I mean, they have to compete in an environment where there are fit cats out there and a prey base that's being reduced because people hunt the same food that they eat. And on top of that, they're injured. Consequently, it's an easy thing for them to turn to domestic animals or livestock. And that's what causes the problem. Now, if they're let back into the wild, they go back to their same old ways, or they wouldn't live, or they'd be accustomed to people, and they would think, oh, here's all I have to do is give a high five or roll, and I'll get a piece of chicken, and they'll get shot. So the dilemma is that if they could be turned back into the wild, we certainly would. That would make me happy, but it would be a death knell for the cat.
Do you have a limit on how many jaguars you can take?
We haven't had a jaguar come in a while, but I would say if they kept piling up, we'd have to say no more, but I would find a way to take more. I would find a way to expand. I have plenty of room back there to expand, so that really wouldn't be a problem. I don't see where that would be a problem. And I mean, there will never be a situation where we're getting 50 cats a year. There are less than 800 left in Belize, and the majority of those cats are in the wild. It's the marginal cats that wander into people's, you know, human habitat and start molesting livestock or dogs or chickens, and those are the cats that we end up with. But those are the cats that are on the fringe, certainly not the majority of the wild population.
Now, Belize has a fair number of jaguars, and also boasts the world's only jaguar sanctuary. And so I was wondering about the wild population and what the threats are and if there's a lot of enough land for the jaguars.
What we're trying to do is there has to be forest connectivity. Even really intelligent people think, oh, well, here's a jaguar, the problem jaguar. We have the Coxco Basin Wildlife Sanctuary specifically set aside for jaguars. Let's put them there. Well, guess what, guys? It doesn't work that way. That's the name of a tract of forest about 150,000 acres. Okay? Now, the magic of that forest is that it connects with other forests. Do you think those jaguars stay there? There's a lot of prey base there because there's no hunting, so they will hunt there, but they move in and out of the coxcomb, which is their nature. So the important thing, in order to ensure that they remain in the coxcomb, which is an absolutely stunning forest, and you go there, the birding is fantastic. You do see jaguar tracks. Some people have seen jaguars. It is wonderful. But the cats do not stay there. They move around. They're very itinerant. So they go north, they go south, and the challenge to keeping jaguars is keeping the forest intact as a corridor. And that's where Belize excels over other Central American countries. We do have the corridor concept still on the playing board, and that's where the zoo is important, because we are in the central biological corridor, which is does have jaguars there. We have jaguars that come around to the zoo. Omar Figueroa has a jaguar currently radio collared right behind the zoo. Now, having that habitat remain as a forest is essential. A jaguar will roam 100 miles a day in search of prey easily. These guys roam, and that's what is attributed to having them minus any subspecies. It's unlike the tiger or the lion or the leopard. With the jaguar, it is just Panthera onca. There are no subspecies. The reason for that is because genetically, the population is in a different state because they roam so much. They're not isolates. And a jaguar may be at point A and have a mate 75 miles north. You see what I'm saying? So their genetic interchange is at a much higher and active rate than other large cats. So in order to maintain a healthy population in jaguars, you do need corridors. That's the nature of the cat. They have to have good forests. A forest of high integrity, healthy standing forest, and they need to roam and be protected. So that's the challenge that we face, and that's what we're up at, actually putting forward right now with the Jaguar Corridor. We do a lot of education to support and empower that whole concept.
How does the coxcomb connect to other forest areas?
If you get a map of Belize and you look at the coxcomb, if you Google protected areas of Belize, for instance, you will see that the coxcomb does not sit alone. It hooks on to the Maya Mountain Forest Reserve. It hooks on to forests further south. Yeah, you're right. If it were solely the coxcomb, that's exactly my point, it would not be enough to sustain jaguars. It needs to connect with the forest that it presently connects with. So the challenge is keeping those connections viable. Okay, so yeah, getting a map and seeing how the forest program actually is in Belize would be really helpful in your to get in your mind how it works. If you look at Costa Rica as a contrast, you see islands of forest. Costa Rica doesn't have connectivity. It is a country, and then you look at the protected areas, and there's one here and one up there, and there is no connectivity there. Belize has it. And that's what we really want to try and maintain.
Are there efforts to maintain it internationally as well?
Absolutely. The organization at the forefront on that effort is Panthera, which is based in New York. And it's a very logical connection because the CEO and president is Alan Rabinowitz, who kickstarted the first jaguar ecology study in the 80s in the coxcomb. He actually traveled around the whole country sampling forests and decided the coxcomb would be the place to do jaguar research, which he did. And that led to the establishment of the Coxcomb Basin Wildlife Sanctuary. He persuaded government that that would be a sound move forward for them. And that's how that came to be.
Are jaguars protected from hunting? You were talking about the conflict with cattle and jaguars being shot. Is that legal to shoot a problem jaguar?
There is a law in the Wildlife Protection Act, or a mandate in the Wildlife Protection Act that says that if a jaguar is molesting human property, you have to get permission from the Forest Department to shoot them. But it can happen. And that's why the rehab program started. It was an option to that. But yeah, they're officially protected. And that doesn't mean they're still not hunted and shot. And that's why we are stepping forward with this very aggressive program to try and curtail selling souvenirs to people made out of body parts of jaguars.
Is that common? What kind of souvenirs are being sold? And is it solely within Belize, or is it sold internationally as well?
Well, it's a problem throughout the range of the jaguar. It happens. I know it happens in Brazil. I know it happens in Honduras. And I know it happens in Belize because I did survey work. Not over a long period of time. I inquired to people. I went into the souvenir shops. And the item for sale is always the canine teeth on a necklace. A hunter will sell it for $50 a tooth, and the shop will sell it for $100. And unfortunately, it's happening throughout the country. I've seen them for sale. I've gotten stories from people who have been approached by Belizeans who will sell them these artifacts. And the target customer is a tourist. If the tourist doesn't know any better, oh, cool, I saw a jaguar at the zoo, or I saw footprints in the Coxcomb Basin, hey, I can have a tooth. That's a great souvenir. If they don't know any better, they will buy it. And what we're trying to do is really just knock it out. I had a meeting with the Forest Department just on Friday. The idea, it's a poster with a beautiful picture of a jaguar, and it says, "The jaguar, help me or hurt me," and just a little blurb about, "Don't buy souvenirs made from body parts of the jaguar." And there's a picture of a canine tooth on a necklace with a red circle and a line through it. And then we're going to invite every conservation organization in Belize to put their logo on it at no cost, so that it really is looking like a unified, concerted effort throughout the country to stop this. And it will be gone. This poster will be in the airport, will be in all the little airports where people fly, you know, to little hubs like Placencia or down south, and where they pick up something and read it. And that way we'll just saturate Belize. So that's the plan, just hoping it works, because it really is a problem and one that isn't being addressed.
Are the jaguars being hunted specifically for their teeth, or it's really a byproduct?
There is not a byproduct. There's nothing you can do with the skin. You can't sell the skin to anybody, because that would be, you'd get caught definitely doing that. The teeth, you have to keep in mind, economically, we're not doing well here. So, yeah, if somebody can get $50 for one tooth, he's going to do it. He's going to shoot the cat. If they don't eat the meat, they'll shoot the cat and take the teeth and the claws and the claws. Claws are worth money as well. And they'll take all the teeth.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you for your interest. I really appreciate that.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about the Belize Zoo and its jaguar rehabilitation program with Sharon Matola, founder and director of the Belize Zoo.
Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.